Hello, welcome to Notable Nobels, a podcast about the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. My name is Harrison Doolin. I'm a postdoctoral scientist at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle, and I will be your host for this web series. Now, the purpose of this series is to trace key advancements made in the biological and medical sciences over the past 120 years or so, and we're using the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine as a guide. Now, every career has its highest prize, and for scientists, that prize is the Nobel Prize. It's the most prestigious award a scientist can receive, and it marks discoveries that have made a profound impact on our understanding of biology and our ability to treat diseases. Today, we will be examining the 2023 Prize in Physiology or Medicine, which was awarded to Katalin Karikó and Drew Weissman. The Nobel Assembly at the Karolinska Institute chose to give Karikó and Weissman the award, quote, for their discoveries concerning nucleoside base modifications that have enabled the development of effective mRNA vaccines against COVID-19, unquote. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic was the most significant infectious disease health crisis in a century. Its impact has been enormous. Literally thousands of books have been written about COVID. Before recording this episode, I went on Amazon's website, selected the books category, typed in COVID, and then clicked the search button. I got over 50,000 results back. So with many different potential COVID topics to talk about, I want to narrow our focus before we get started. The focus of today's episode is the science behind the first FDA-approved mRNA vaccines. We will begin with this question. How do you make an mRNA vaccine? Well, broadly speaking, you need three things. Number one, you need to identify a target protein that the immune system will recognize. Number two, you need to make an mRNA that codes for that target protein. And number three, you need a way to get that mRNA into a person's cells so that the cells can make the target protein. We'll discuss how each of these criteria were met for the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines, how the mRNA vaccines were effectively used during the COVID pandemic, and I'll end with a word about serendipity in science. But first, some background on our Nobel laureates, and we begin with Karikó. Katalin Karikó was born in 1955 in communist Hungary. Her father was a butcher, her mother was a bookkeeper, and she grew up in an agricultural community. However, she always liked school and worked hard at her studies. She performed well academically, and after finishing high school, she attended the University of Szeged in Hungary. After earning her bachelor's degree, she got a job as a postdoctoral researcher at Hungary's Biological Research Center. But the lab she was working in ran out of money in 1985, and she was laid off. She was offered a new job as a postdoctoral researcher at Temple University in Philadelphia, and so she emigrated to the United States with her husband and daughter. After 3 years at Temple, she again switched jobs to work as a postdoctoral scientist at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland. She stayed there for a year, but she searched for ways to return to Philadelphia where her family was at. She eventually landed an assistant professor position at the University of Pennsylvania. Although she spent a lot of time bouncing around jobs, Karikó's research interest was always the same. She was interested in RNA. She was particularly intrigued by the idea of using mRNA as a therapeutic. She saw that mRNA had a wide range of possible applications, and she was interested in using it for gene therapy, for heart and neurological diseases. However, though she was enthusiastic about her work, the grants she applied for were routinely rejected, and she was unable to bring in funding for her research. Unfortunately for her, research money in academia is kind of a big deal. At the top universities in the United States, especially Ivy League institutions like Penn, the university expects their scientific faculty members to support their work through outside funding, usually in the form of grants. Now, approximately 25-33% of grant money doesn't actually go to the researcher. Instead, it goes to the university to cover the costs of maintaining the research facilities their scientists use, such as buildings and lab space. If a university feels that a scientist is not bringing in enough grant money to support their research, they will deem that person unfit to use the university's buildings and lab space. This is unfortunately what happened to Katalin Karikó. In 1995, she was denied tenure and spent the next 18 years as a staff scientist bouncing around from lab to lab at the university. While her situation was viewed by many as a career dead end, she continued to work diligently on mRNA. Her lack of funding continued to put her at odds with the university, and her salary was poor, but she nevertheless made the most of the situation. Penn, after all, was an excellent environment for research, and she regularly got to interact with scientists who were at the top of their fields. One such interaction proved to be particularly serendipitous. One day in 1997, Karikó went to the library at Penn to browse the latest journal articles. Finding some articles that interested her, she went to her usual photocopier to make copies. However, someone else was using the machine. Seeing that she was going to have to wait, she decided to strike up a conversation. So who was this person at the photocopier? It was Drew Weissman, our second Nobel laureate for today's episode. In many ways, Drew Weissman was the opposite of the immigrant woman who introduced herself while waiting to use the copier. Karikó was enthusiastic and talkative. Weissman, on the other hand, was known for being a man of few words and fewer expressions. Their upbringings were also extremely different. Weissman was born in 1959 in Massachusetts and grew up Jewish. He was bright and hardworking, though he enjoyed sailing along the coast with his family and playing tennis. He attended Brandeis University and graduated in 1981 with bachelor's and master's degrees in biochemistry. He then entered a dual MD-PhD program at Boston University, which he graduated from in 1987. His work focused on immunology and infectious diseases. After finishing his residency, he obtained a fellowship to work in the lab of Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health, where he continued to work on infectious diseases such as influenza and HIV. In 1997, he was offered a position at the University of Pennsylvania to start his own laboratory, which he accepted. It was at the University of Pennsylvania that he would serendipitously meet Katalin Karikó at the photocopier. Here's how Karikó describes what happened next in her autobiography. Quote, "Again and again in biology, lock meets key and big things happen. I didn't know it yet, but standing there at the copy machine, I just clicked into my own lock and key system. Drew and I were very different, but each of us had exactly the knowledge and skill that the other needed. I was an RNA scientist who didn't know much about immunology. He was an immunologist without RNA experience. Our connection would set into motion a cascade of events that would change, well, everything." Unquote. But before we get into Karikó and Weissman's research and the big changes that it brought, let's go through some definitions. What are vaccines and what is mRNA? First off, vaccines. A vaccine is a substance used to stimulate an immune response and provide immune protection against a disease. Vaccines have been around for a long time. The term vaccine originated with Edward Jenner in his 1797 work with smallpox virus. Jenner was a doctor working in Great Britain, and in the course of his duties, he observed that milkmaids in Britain who developed cowpox, a mild disease, were protected against smallpox, a highly deadly disease. Going off that observation, Jenner began deliberately infecting people with cowpox to see if they could be protected against smallpox, and he found that they could be. Jenner's cowpox infection technique was called vaccination, which is derived from the word vacca, the Latin word for cow. Building on Jenner's work, scientists in the 19th and 20th centuries developed techniques to create vaccines against a wide range of pathogens. They also found that there were many different ways to make a vaccine. For example, vaccines could be live viruses that had been attenuated to prevent disease. Live attenuated virus vaccines include Max Thaler's yellow fever vaccine, Albert Sabin's polio vaccine, and the MMR vaccine used to protect against measles, mumps, and rubella. Another class of vaccines were developed that involved killing the virus with some combination of chemicals, heat, or radiation. this killed version of the virus can no longer make the person sick, but it can still be recognized by the immune system to produce the immune responses that protect against the live version of the virus. Examples of this kind of vaccine include the Jonas Salk polio vaccine and some of the current flu vaccines. Then, as scientists began to better understand the molecular biology of infections and immunity, they realized that often immunity to one specific viral protein was sufficient to protect against disease. This created a third class of vaccines called either the subunit or recombinant vaccines. An example of this type of vaccine is the current hepatitis B virus vaccine. And finally, a fourth class of vaccines was developed that again took advantage of advancements in molecular biology. This fourth class are called viral vector vaccines. These vaccines use a live attenuated virus, but the attenuated virus is not the main target of the vaccine. Instead, the live attenuated virus is genetically engineered to introduce a gene from a completely different virus into the cells. This completely different virus is the real target of the vaccine. And an example of a viral vectored vaccine is the recently approved Merck Ebola vaccine. By the start of the 21st century, these different vaccine classes were well established and had saved hundreds of millions of lives. But despite all these success stories, vaccines were not as effective at eliminating plenty of other diseases. For example, there is still no effective vaccine against HIV, and vaccines against pathogens like influenza and malaria are only modestly effective. So scientists continued to look for ways to improve vaccines and sought to better understand how the immune system responds to vaccines. As their understanding grew, scientists noticed that inactivated and recombinant vaccines often didn't produce as strong an immune response compared to live attenuated vaccines or natural infections. Specifically, inactivated and recombinant vaccines were not as good at eliciting responses from a type of immune cell called the T cell. A subset of T cells function kind of like the special forces of the immune system. These T cells can identify and kill infected cells, which keeps the pathogen from spreading. Scientists realized that vaccines that produced viral antigens inside infected cells were better at eliciting these T cell responses. So scientists came up with a fourth class of vaccines that could produce these viral antigens inside a person's cells. This new class of vaccines is the nucleic acid vaccines, which include mRNA vaccines. So what is mRNA? mRNA belongs to a class of molecules called nucleic acids. Nucleic acids are fundamental molecules essential to all living things. Our cells have two main types of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. DNA, as you are probably aware, contains the genetic information of the cell, or in other words, genes are made of DNA. The typical functional output of a gene is a protein. Proteins are like the workhorse molecules of the cell. They allow the cell to, like, do things. But the process of making a protein from a gene requires an intermediary molecule, and that molecule is mRNA. When a cell wants to use a gene, in other words, to turn a gene on and start making protein, the cell produces an RNA copy of the gene's DNA. This process of using DNA to make RNA is called transcription. Cells produce many types of RNA, but the RNAs used to make protein are called messenger RNA, or mRNA for short. Once the genetic information has been converted from DNA to mRNA, the cell needs to convert that information into protein, and the process of converting an mRNA molecule to protein is called translation. All organisms, including viruses, rely on RNA translation to make proteins. So vaccine scientists reasoned that if they introduced an mRNA into a cell that coded for a viral protein, then the cell would make the viral protein and the protein would be recognized by the immune system, which would then produce an immune response that could fight off the pathogen. Sounds pretty straightforward, right? But there were some technical challenges that needed to be overcome before these mRNA vaccines could be put to use. That brings us back to the experiments done by Carrico and Weissman at the University of Pennsylvania. Carrico and Weissman were working on an HIV mRNA vaccine. They chemically synthesized an mRNA coding for an HIV protein called GAG. They needed to show that this mRNA could make the HIV target protein in cell culture, but when they added the mRNA to cells, something unexpected happened. The cells made the HIV GAG protein, but they also made copious amounts of inflammatory cytokines. So what are inflammatory cytokines? Inflammatory cytokines are molecules that signal to the rest of the body that a pathogen is present. Inflammatory cytokines are what lead to the redness, swelling, and fevers that you get when you are sick. Now, on the one hand, cytokines are a good thing because they activate the immune system to start fighting the pathogen. However, high amounts of cytokines can make you sick, sometimes very sick. And if you get cytokines produced in super high amounts, all at once, you get a condition called cytokine storm, which can be life-threatening. Now, Carrico and Weissman, while they did want their vaccine to be immunogenic, they didn't want it to be that immunogenic. But it was perplexing that the cells had responded so provocatively to their mRNA. After all, every single cell on the entire planet makes mRNA, including the cells they had used for their test. And the mRNA the cells made naturally wasn't triggering an immune response. So what was going on? Well, clearly there was something different about the mRNA made by the cells versus the mRNA made synthetically by Carrico in her lab. So the pair set about trying to figure out what that difference was. Their next step was to transfect cells with different types of RNA from different types of cells. They found that RNA extracted from bacteria produced similarly extremely high levels of cytokines, just like their vaccine mRNA. However, mRNA extracted from mammalian cells produced hardly any cytokines. They also looked at another class of RNAs found naturally inside cells called tRNAs. Cells transfected with these tRNAs did not produce any cytokines at all. So the question became, what was different about the tRNAs and mammalian mRNAs from the bacterial RNA and their vaccine mRNA? From work done by other RNA biologists, Carrico and Weissman knew that the tRNAs and mammalian mRNAs contained chemical modifications not found in bacteria mRNAs or their lab-made mRNAs. The pair decided to introduce these chemical modifications to their lab-made mRNAs to see if this would solve the cytokine problem. Lo and behold, when they introduced the modified mRNAs to cells, they could completely suppress the cytokine response. One particular modification called pseudouridine was particularly good at suppressing the cytokine response. On top of this, the researchers found that incorporating pseudouridine into mRNAs greatly increased the amount of protein produced by the mRNA. Carrico and Weissman published their findings in a series of papers between 2005 and 2010, over a decade before the COVID-19 pandemic. However, their results stayed out of the mainstream news. mRNA therapeutics were still viewed as not very promising technology. Carrico and Weissman knew there was still work to be done if mRNA vaccines could be put to good use. The most pressing need that they had was a way to get the mRNA into patient cells. The techniques they had used in cell culture weren't fit for human use. So in 2014, they contacted a Canadian biotech company they believed would be able to help solve their problem. This brings us to the topic of lipid nanoparticles for mRNA vaccine delivery. And no conversation about therapeutic lipid nanoparticles is complete without mentioning the work of Dr. Peter Cullis. While Peter Cullis did not share the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine with Kotlin Carrico and Drew Weissman, his contributions to the mRNA vaccines were equally as important, and I would not be at all surprised if his work eventually wins him a Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Cullis was born in 1946 and grew up in British Columbia, Canada. He completed his PhD in solid-state physics at the University of British Columbia in 1972. He then moved to Oxford, England to do postdoctoral work in biochemistry. It was at Oxford that he started working on lipid membranes. In the 1980s, he moved back to the University of British Columbia to start his own lab studying lipids. Lipids are one of the fundamental building blocks of cells. Lipids come together to form the cell membrane, which is the outer barrier that defines the inside of a cell from the outside of a cell. Lipid membranes also form many of the organelles inside cells, and cells can use vesicles made of lipid membranes to transport materials around a cell. Lipid vesicles made by cells can be pinched off of an existing lipid membrane, or they can fuse together to form bigger vesicles. Cullis was interested in studying lipid membranes at a fundamental level, simply to understand how cells worked. To do that, he began synthesizing lipids and combining them in different ways to form membranes. The membranes could come together to form spheres similar to the vesicles used by cells. While Cullis was originally interested in these lipid nanoparticles as models for understanding fundamental principles of biology, his lab quickly became interested in the potential of these nanoparticles to deliver drugs. But before they could advance lipid nanoparticle therapies, they had a toxicity issue. Like other nucleic acid molecules, RNA has an overall negative charge. In order to get the RNA into the lipid nanoparticle, Cullis's lab had used permanently positively charged lipids to form the nanoparticle. However, cells don't really like positively charged lipids. Permanently positively charged lipids are not found anywhere in nature, and they are highly toxic when introduced to cells. To overcome this problem, Cullis's team developed a class of lipids called ionizable lipids. Unlike the permanently positively charged lipids, the ionizable lipids are only positively charged under acidic conditions. Here's what that allowed Cullis's team to do. The nanoparticles could be assembled with the RNA under acidic conditions when the ionizable lipids had a positive charge. Then, once the nanoparticles were assembled, the ionizable lipids became neutrally charged under normal cellular conditions, which made them less toxic. The first ionizable lipid, called DODAP, or AL1, was synthesized by Cullis's lab and reported in the journal Biochemistry in 1994. In 2001, Cullis's lab showed that DODAP could effectively encapsulate small RNA molecules. Excited by the possible therapeutic applications of the new lipid, Cullis helped start a biotech company called Acuitas Therapeutics in 2009. Acuitas began partnering with various pharmaceutical companies to target diseases using RNA-encapsulated lipid nanoparticles. In 2014, Cullis's company was approached by Drew Weissman and Katalin Karikó to develop mRNA vaccines delivered in lipid nanoparticles. The year prior, Karikó had left the University of Pennsylvania to join the German biotech company BioNTech. Acuitas began working with BioNTech on mRNA vaccines targeting various pathogens like Zika and influenza viruses. Then, in 2020, all other projects were put on hold to deal with a new viral pathogen that was spreading around the globe at rapid speed. I'm talking, of course, about SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. When the COVID pandemic began to get global attention in the spring of 2020, scientists everywhere jumped on the challenge to get the public a COVID vaccine as quickly as possible. Anyone and everyone with experience designing vaccines started working on COVID, even me. I was only a grad student halfway through my PhD at the time, and as soon as I was allowed back in the lab after the stricter lockdowns were lifted, I got to work designing my own COVID vaccine, which, if you're curious, you can read about in the paper I published in the Journal of Virology. But clearly, a vaccine for general use was going to come not from me, but from one of the major pharmaceutical companies with the experience and facilities needed to produce billions of doses of vaccine. As the world was in a state of panic not seen in nearly a century, there was enormous pressure to produce a vaccine quickly. At the peak of the first wave of the pandemic, deaths from COVID-19 in the United States were topping over 2,000 per day, and tens of thousands more were getting sick. The pressure was on to do something and do it fast, and naturally everyone's attention focused on a vaccine. But how to get a COVID vaccine quickly? Prior to 2020, the fastest vaccine ever approved by the FDA was a mumps vaccine that took 4 years to roll out, and most vaccines took an average of 10 years to develop. To help speed up the process, the American government initiated a program called Operation Warp Speed. As part of this program, over $10 billion American dollars were given to pharmaceutical companies to begin manufacturing COVID-19 vaccines, even before it was known if the vaccines would be effective. Pharmaceutical companies would normally never take such a financially risky move, but to speed up the vaccine production, the U.S. government absorbed the costs to get the vaccines developed quickly. While government intervention helped clear the financial hurdles to get the vaccines out, there were still the scientific hurdles, which left scientists wondering, what could be done on the vaccine design side of things to get the COVID vaccine as quickly as possible? In other words, which vaccine platform could make vaccine doses fastest? The clear winner in this regard were the mRNA vaccines. Unlike the approved vaccine platforms up to that point, mRNA vaccines could be made entirely by chemical synthesis. In other words, they did not require the production of vaccine materials from live cells. Cells are excellent little factories for producing things like proteins and pseudoviruses that can be used for vaccines, but cells, for all their value, are relatively slow at making their desired product. By contrast, synthesizing mRNA in a test tube only takes a couple of hours. In January of 2020, as soon as the SARS-CoV-2 genomic sequence became available, BioNTech initiated a collaboration with Acuitas Therapeutics and the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer to develop a COVID-19 mRNA lipid nanoparticle vaccine. The mRNA coded for the spike protein of the coronavirus. The spike protein sticks out on the surface of the virus and allows the virus to attach to cells before infection. Antibodies that bind to the spike protein prevent the virus from getting inside the cell and replicating. This makes spike a great vaccine target. The BioNTech Pfizer vaccines used both mRNA containing the modified nucleotides discovered by Carrico and Weissman, and also the ionizable lipids developed by Cullis. Pfizer's manufacturing might was used to produce billions of doses of the vaccine, and a similar mRNA vaccine was produced by the Massachusetts pharmaceutical company Moderna. Now, even though these vaccines could be produced faster than other vaccines, there was no guarantee that they would work. The world held its breath in 2020, waiting for the results of the clinical trials to come back. Then in November of 2020, less than a year since the first cases of COVID-19 were reported in China, both Pfizer and Moderna shared their initial results from their phase 3 clinical trials. In the first 3 months after vaccination, both mRNA vaccines were 90% effective at preventing symptomatic COVID-19. After completing the FDA requirements, both mRNA vaccines were authorized for distribution in the US in December 2020. Since then, billions of doses of mRNA vaccines have been administered around the world, saving the lives of millions of people. This was a truly remarkable accomplishment, and in recognition of their landmark finding that made the mRNA vaccines possible, the Nobel Assembly awarded the 2023 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine to Katalin Karikó and Drew Weissman. Now, as part of the Nobel Prize Awards ceremony held in Sweden every year, new laureates are asked to donate something to the Nobel Prize Museum in Stockholm. In honor of his very first meeting with Karikó at the University of Pennsylvania Library, Drew Weissman donated a photocopier. So presently, where do mRNA technologies and COVID vaccines stand now that we're 4 years past the start of the pandemic? Well, we've had to moderate our expectations of the COVID-19 vaccines a bit. Obviously, COVID is still around, despite the vaccines being widely used, and there are a few reasons for this. The first reason is that the virus continues to mutate as it circulates around the world, which has given rise to new virus variants that can escape the immune responses elicited by the initial vaccines. Fortunately, because mRNA vaccines can be developed very quickly, mRNA vaccines targeting the new variants are being used, but even with the improved manufacturing speed of the mRNA vaccines, the virus seems to be able to stay one step ahead of us. Another limitation of COVID vaccines, not just the mRNA vaccines, but all COVID vaccines, is that the immune responses wane a bit in the 3 to 6 months after vaccination. Finally, the current vaccines give relatively weak mucosal immune responses in the upper respiratory tract, the site of initial COVID infection. So there is still plenty of room for improvement with the COVID vaccines. Nevertheless, the vaccines used so far can be credited with saving literally millions of lives around the world. The mRNA vaccines have also generated interest in mRNA therapeutics beyond vaccination. Scientists want to develop mRNA technology to treat diseases like cancer and genetic conditions. The coming years will see many of these therapies tested in clinical trials, and I, for one, am very interested to see how far these therapies can go. As I wrap up this episode, I want to say a word about what the 2023 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine tells us about the way science is done. Hopefully you can see the outsized role serendipity played in the unfolding of the first mRNA vaccines. A casual meeting at a photocopier led to the start of Carrico and Weissman's collaboration. Peter Cullis's interest in cell membranes led to the discovery of ionizable lipids for mRNA delivery. And an unexpected coronavirus outbreak brought mRNA vaccines to center stage when before they'd been on the back burner. It's very often the unexpected things that result in big scientific breakthroughs. Now, this creates a problem if you want to give money to fund important scientific discoveries, because often we don't know what's going to lead to the next big thing. Carrico and Weissman had an extremely hard time funding their work 20 years ago, which just goes to show you how hard it is to pick the winning scientific horse, so to speak. While their story is discouraging in that regard, the later part of the COVID vaccine story is highly encouraging, because once scientific expertise was combined with the billions of dollars that were made available to find a vaccine, we ended up with not one, but two highly effective mRNA vaccines. This shows that great things can happen if a problem is given sufficient resources and attention. Think of what other problems could be solved if they were treated the same way as the COVID vaccines. Who knows, we might see some more Nobel Prizes come out of it, and also some really great benefits for humanity. Okay, that concludes this episode of Notable Nobels. This episode was recorded on February 6th, 2024. I want to thank Digital Mind Productions for providing the music, and Nicholas Nguyen for the graphic design. If you would like to know more about the 2023 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, you can read Katalin Karikó's autobiography, which was just published last October. Its title is Breaking Through: My Life in Science. Next time on Notable Nobels, we'll be looking at some discoveries that were made when an unlikely person looked in some unlikely places. Her findings led to the development of several widely used drugs that have been essential in fighting infectious diseases. Want to know more? Well, listen next time to find out. Thanks so much for listening. See you then.